On March 8th and 9th, 2010, Cleveland Right to Life launched the first annual Bringing America Back to Life symposium and exhibition dedicated to the entire spectrum of issues that make up our journey to pave the way to a full understanding of the sanctity of life in our culture. Through prayer, action, voting, and education, we will pave the way to achieve this goal. We know you will be edified and encouraged as you listen to our roster of 12 fine speakers who, with their thoughtful, lively, expert presentations, eloquently defend the right to life.
Good morning, you early birds. It's great to be here and lead off a wonderful second day, and to be introduced by Raymond is a special thing, and to see Star and all of you out. It's a remarkable couple of weeks for me, as I was telling Molly, the indomitable Molly is what I'm going to begin to call her, to the woman who must be obeyed. That used to be an English character. And about a year ago, when I was here with a WHK event, Molly buttonholed me and said, "The Archbishop is coming. Will you introduce him?" And I said, "Well, for him, I will do that. Because, and for you, pro-life in Cleveland is really such a trendsetter. I will come," not realizing that I was committing to this particular day, because this particular day turned out to be at the end of a very long journey in America. I'm an inexpert traveler. I don't organize it well. If it weren't for the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt, my wonderful wife, I don't know where I would be. But I arrived here this morning at 6:15 in the morning at the airport from San Francisco yesterday, where I had journeyed from the day before in Atlanta, having missed a flight because I was sitting at my computer working. So it's been a wild 48 hours, but I am glad to be here for the very reason I was glad to be in San Francisco yesterday. I was making an argument. It was before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and I was arguing to a very, very liberal judge by the name of Stephen Reinhart and to a very, very conservative judge by the name of Jay Bybee and one in between. And I liked that so much because it was a conversation about important stuff. This was a property rights case, an endangered species case. And it took me about 45 minutes back and forth arguing about the merits with left and right. And that's what we're called to do. We are not called to sit back passively and allow people to assume that what they believe to be true is in fact true when it's not. We're not called to be observers. We are called to be participants on a daily basis in the arguments of life, and there is no more important argument than this one. I'm also pleased to be here because the next time you'll see me, unless you come back and watch the show later today, when I broadcast from here from 6 to 8, interrupting your fine dinner, I'll pop up here to introduce the Archbishop, who is to me one of the most inspirational figures in America right now. He is doing what I've longed to have done in America by the church for a long time, which is leading with the mind, not just the heart and the sacraments which come first, but leading with the mind. When I was a young lawyer in the Reagan White House, one of the great trials, and I many of you know this, that I shared an office back in those days with the Chief Justice of the United States, and it was an amazing time to be part of an amazing moment to work for the Gipper, et cetera. But the National Catholic Conference of Bishops in those years was lost. It was just lost. We would get letters on nuclear weapons that made no sense. And many of you, especially the young people I see over here, have no idea what it was to be up against the Soviet Union in those years and to have befuddlement on the part of our national Catholic leadership and upon values leaders across the United States. And the bishops would send us these letters on nuclear weapons or on poverty. And they didn't understand how and why you would escape from poverty and the way that the world would work. And I wondered, at that time, by the way, the chairman of the National Conference of Bishops was the man who confirmed me, Bishop Malone of Youngstown. And so when I'd get these letters from Bishop Malone, I'd say, "Wait a minute, I know you don't know anything about nuclear weapons." And it was just very dispiriting. But in the last 10 years, there has emerged such a body of great leaders in the American Catholic Church, and they have parallels on the evangelical side, of people who are now arguing, making points with their mind. And I think this conference is a testament to the impact of that kind of leadership. And it's a testament to the impact that one person, Molly, can have, the chancellor can have in concert with Molly, that each of you can have if you just put your mind to it, provided you see other people doing it, that you're not alone, and that our leaders lead from the front. And that's why I was pleased to, it's been an interesting run around the bases from Colorado Springs to Texas to the Caribbean, back to Miami to Atlanta to San Francisco to here. Been a wild 10 days, but I wouldn't miss it, because I wouldn't miss the opportunity to say to everyone tonight what it is that we have a leader in the Archbishop, and would that they all led that way, as in fact many have begun to do and will continue to do. Second reason, though, it's a crucial time. I'm coming back in April with my friend Michael Medved. We're going to do a big event called America Unplugged. I think it's on April 22nd. Am I right about that, Mark? Mark is the general manager of WHK. It's always a pleasure to be here with Mark, because Mark always facilitates our visits in and out of my favorite market in the world since it's home. It's also good to come in on a day that we signed Seneca Williams. I like that. That's a good deal. Good to have a good backup like that. But I will be back on April 22nd, and at that point, the battle will be over on health care. The Obamacare package will either have passed or it will not have passed, and we'll be assessing what's going on. But right now, this conference, providentially so, is occurring in the most crucial 3 weeks for life in America since Roe v. Wade, other than perhaps the confirmation of Justice Roberts and Alito. And that's because in the next 3 weeks, the House of Representatives is going to decide whether or not to publicly fund abortion. So in one respect, you'll hear me say this, we ought not to be here today. We ought to be at our homes and at our computers phoning and emailing every single member of the House of Representatives. If you go to my website this morning, hughhewitt.com, you'll see that I have been busy trying to find a headcount, trying to zero in on those Democrats. Not one Republican will vote for this. Congressman Cow of New Orleans, who voted for it last time around, I'm sure he's a friend of Raymond's, and I was going to ask him about it, but our paths have crossed in the night. He has said no, so not one Republican will vote for it. And we need about 37 Democrats to say no. And right now, we have that because of Congressman Bart Stupak in Michigan. And if I could ask you to do, yes, it's important. If I could ask each one of you to call his office and say thank you, please continue to stand in the gap. 202-224-3121, 202-225-3121. I say it every night on my radio show. These are the phone calls that drive things. And if you know anyone in Michigan, in his district, call them up and ask them to call the congressman and tell him to stand strong, because every weapon of persuasion, both fair and unfair, every bit of pressure that can be brought to bear, and it's enormous. There is an impact to the Oval Office. There's an impact to the presidency. There's an impact to the speaker that can be brought to bear on an individual, which is shattering. It's not as big as God, but it's awfully impressive for those of us on this planet. And it will be brought to bear on Bart Stupak, because if Bart Stupak can be made to turn, he will change his mind. And the key is the Senate bill. There are two versions, and I'm sure you know this. The Senate bill funds abortion. There's no way around it. They try and dress it up. Ben Nelson, allegedly a pro-life senator from Nebraska, said my version works that way, and it doesn't. Obamacare, as it is intended to pass out of the Senate, will fund abortion. Though it's very complicated, the subsidy will be real, and there will never be any turning back. That's the last line, the truce, the deal that was reached after the 1973 cave by the Supreme Court. The Congress quickly, under the leadership of Henry Hyde, reached an accommodation in which they said, we understand this issue is not appropriate that taxpayers would fund one way or the other. It's the only issue on which we have that consensus, that it is so deeply divisive, that our approach to it is so certain and so convicted, based not upon the law of the United States, but upon God's law, that we would not be obliged to fund this. And that truce is held from 1973 forward, and it's in danger right now. The next 3 weeks will decide that. Because once it is subsidized, you will see it spread like it did in Europe, so that it will become a preferred alternative. Please understand that when the government runs out of money for health care, as they will, one of the ways in which they will try and balance the budget will be by decreasing the population they have to serve. The inevitability of that is, to me, so obvious that when you run out of money, that the mere acceptance of this principle now will grow and grow and grow. So these next 3 weeks are so crucial. But that's not the only reason that Obamacare needs to be stopped. And I'm speaking very bluntly, and I know I have some Democratic friends here, and I hope I can persuade you on it. There are four other reasons. Number two, the rights of conscience will be impaired for hospital workers. It will become what the government says you must do, you will do. Because if you take the government's coin, then the government's coin is going to insist that you play to the government's tune. And rights of conscience are already impaired across the United States by people who do not want to perform abortion, by people who do not want to counsel abortion, and even in Catholic hospitals. Rights of conscience have been compromised in Catholic adoption agencies across the United States, and the church is fighting back in many places with regards to that. And many evangelical friends and many of our friends across the faith spectrum realize the pressures that are being brought to bear when they are called upon to act against life and they do not want to do it. Once the government has its hand in every single medical operation as a funder, there will be no more private choice. My friends at the Alliance Defense Fund, run by the magnificent Alan Sears, and Alan Sears is probably one of the most important lawyers in American history, in my view. And the ADF gets out there and fights these battles, always brings me up to speed, and they're very hard to contest these things. People don't want to step forward, especially in hard economic times. Are you going to sacrifice your job in order to keep your conscience clear? You're supposed to, but it's a very easy thing to say just this one time. The health bill will make that much, much worse. Number three. Will government fund the elderly? Will government take care of people at the end of their life as opposed to the beginning of their life? Or will they find it convenient, as almost certainly there is nothing called a death panel, and when Sarah Palin said that, she was merely illustrating and using a very popular technique to underline what the consequence would be. So there's nothing officially titled death panel, but there is a momentum in this bill which is so real, which is that, and you hear it all the time, we spend three-quarters of the dollars on the last 5 days of life, et cetera, as though that is somehow wrong, to care for people at the end of their lives and to make sure that they are being assisted and comforted to as much as possible, and that we honor their choices and we honor their lives right to the last moment that they're on this earth as opposed to the next life. That will come under extraordinary heavy weather if Obamacare passes. Reason number four. This one's very, very troubling. One of my law partners is on the national board of the National Down Syndrome Foundation. His wonderful little boy has Downs. And already the American OBGYN profession has begun to urge testing of all pregnant women with the clear, clear intention of terminating children who have the Down syndrome gene. And that will become one of those tentacles of federal care, because that will be viewed as an outlying expense that has no reciprocal benefit. Will we take care of the disabled, or will we begin to test for the disabled so that in the womb they can be dispatched without the cost? There is clearly all going to be driven by cost. It's all about the money in the Obamacare bill. And that's the fourth reason. Finally, the big reason, my friend Dennis Prager made this point over and over again. I should steal it and not give him credit, but that would be wrong. It's okay with regard to his cigars. It's not right with regards to his speech. We were together a month ago in Baltimore when the Republican congressman had a conference. And they asked Dennis and I to come and speak to them about messaging and communication, because what Molly said when she introduced Raymond matters so much in every setting, not just to congressmen, but to everyone in this room. You've got to communicate. You've got to communicate effectively. You've got to get inside someone's head. You've got to be able to make an argument. You've got to make your point. And Dennis stood up, and he's got a great line. The bigger the government, the smaller the citizen. And that is just simply true. The bigger the government, the smaller the citizen. And that is why the expansion of government that is embedded in Obamacare risks not just this crucial consensus, this truce on abortion public funding, not just the care of the elderly, not just the care of the disabled, not just the rights of conscience, but really our very understanding of who we are and how we govern ourselves. And so this is the moment in which we all have to get up and work hard. When Dennis gave that line, the bigger the government, the smaller the citizen, he got a standing ovation. Now, that made me jealous, of course. But he didn't even notice it. He was sitting there. I said, Dennis, congressmen are, you know, 150 Republican congressmen there in the middle of a snowstorm in Baltimore. And they were standing up and they were applauding him ferociously, extended. And I overcame my jealousy. And I was thinking to myself, that is really an evident of where we are. They want passion. They want genuine conviction. For a long, long time, elected officials have not known how to deal with the pro-life movement because it's based upon genuine passion and conviction. Our country has been somewhat passionless about politics for a very long time, until the last 3 to 4 years, perhaps triggered by the Iraq War, perhaps triggered by the stresses of the economic collapse. But whatever it is now evident everywhere that citizens are involved at a level they have not been in as long as I've been in public life, and I'm 54 years old, and I've been doing this since I was 18. And now they are so deeply involved, so deeply motivated. They come to Tea Party gatherings. They come to gatherings like this organized around a principle which may have previously animated them only on their knees and not in their public life. And even congresspeople want to be inspired and want to be encouraged and want to be led. So those of you who have been working in the vineyard for a very long time and wondering whether or not there was ever going to be a harvest, this is the harvest. It's 900 to 1,000 people at a conference like this. It's people who newly activated say they will get involved. It's every night I listen on my radio show and people call up who've never done a thing before. Never got out of their couch. You know, I make jokes about the Browns and the Tribe and the Cavs. And, you know, there are lots of people out there who've taken their life cues from observing as opposed to doing. I think that is very, very much changing. And it's especially changing with regards to the rights of the unborn. And I think for a very, very real reason, I saw one of your speakers was talking about yesterday, demographic winter. I think that all of us have known that natural law dictates that we take care of life, both unborn and yet to be born and after it is born. But I also don't think that many of us focused on population dynamics around the world. I don't think we realized that we were breeding ourselves out of existence in Europe, that the great, wonderful nation states of Europe, which cradled civilization and Christianity, are now facing demographic eclipse and the kind of birth rates which cannot be undone in a generation or two, and that the same thing threatens the United States. My favorite radio lefty, he comes on my radio show often. I spent 7 hours with him talking about his book, is E.J. Dionne. E.J. is a wonderful Catholic man. He's a fine, fine writer, a couple years older than me. We have the same sort of educational experience, same kind of background. Both of his parents were teachers, and they valued very much education. And E.J. is a devout Catholic who's wrong about abortion and who is wrong about health care and who's wrong about everything. So why did that happen? And it happened because in the 60s, when he was a young person coming up, the church abandoned the argument and the moral formation that is necessary to making him something other than he had all this talent, all this extraordinary talent. It's a bent twig. He's out there deploying that 3 times a week in the Washington Post on the side of the wrong. And we argue back and forth because I know I've got a challenge there as someone who is a near peer in many of the things that we do to try and bring him back around. But when I look at that, I think to myself, what happened? I know what happened. I lived it in 1960s when you're a third grader and everything changes and everything that you do and the whole church kind of gets shaky for a while and it leaves you out there. A generation gets lost. And now the repair work is very, very difficult, but it has to be done. Now, I also want to talk about something that's very important for us as opponents of Obamacare, for all the reasons I talked about, to take very, very seriously. And it's something I'm sure the Archbishop will be talking about tonight as well. We are called to take care of the poor and the stranger. We are called not to be indifferent to the fact that 15% of the population doesn't have health care, that bankruptcies occur all the time, that children are born into very difficult circumstances, that mothers are desperate, that families are stretched, and that many, many people arrive in the United States wanting one thing only, which is an opportunity to take care of their family. I just came back from the Caribbean. It's always so difficult to sail with my radio listeners and go to wonderful places, but to see right behind that facade grinding, bone-crushing poverty, which is why I go to the Dominican Republic with Children International and try and bring people's attention to that. And a lot of those people come here, and they need to be here because it's the only way they can feed their family, and I've always understood why immigrants, legal and illegal, want to come to the United States. But it presents us as faith-based people with a real problem. They're the pro-life movement as well. We have a call to their concerns and their way in the world as well. The Archbishop will always talk about that in the same breath, gently or not so gently, reminding me that my party has become identified, and I am a Republican, a proud Republican, has become identified with indifference to the immigrant and with indifference to the uninsured. I think that's wrong. But it's also something we've got to make arguments about the whole time. It's not just about the preborn, it's after they're born as well. There are ways to fix that problem. There are extraordinary intellects out there who work on this. There are ways to say to America, we know that there is a problem with the uninsured, with portability, with COBRA, with what happens when you have catastrophic illness. We know that. We know that there are children who are born into situations that are not loving and that need to be taken care of. We know that adoption needs to flourish. But we have to be willing to step forward and say that in the same breath that we're saying not Obamacare, not now. So I want to conclude this morning. You've got so much ahead of you and so much more to do. And any of you have questions or comments I'd love to talk to you about, is to please not only go back and persuade people and talk to people about why you were here, to wear that badge proudly and say, as I did on the website the other day, I'm going to the Right to Life Conference. Sometimes that is a little bit of a risk. Sometimes that's a difficult thing to say to people, and they'll look a little bit funny at you. And tell them why you're doing it. But then also ask them, as Molly said, tell 20 people. Not just tell them to come or to volunteer or to engage or especially to contribute, but to call, to get involved in this, to find your congressman. Believe it or not, we can pray that Dennis Kucinich actually understands this. You can call the most liberal member of the United States House of Representatives and say to him or to her that you're calling and you don't agree on much, but you really would like to ask them to please support Bart Stupak, that you really want them to understand why this matters and why they ought not to change this. And if and when they say to you, oh, don't worry, it's not funding abortion in the House, but you say, I must disagree with you. I agree with Congressman Stupak, who's been a pro-life person. Please reconsider. And then to add a little bit of salt, to be salt and light. That's the light part. Here's the salt part. And as much as it pains me to say, I will work to defeat you if you do not protect the unborn. That's what changes congressional lives. That's salt and light. On the radio side of the business, salt is, we got to have it. The light is necessary first when you're trying to change a heart. But when you're trying to change a vote, the salt matters a great deal. And that means follow through. It means identifying who it is that is out there and is running. Earlier today, I have to pull out the name because I just became acquainted with it. I was talking with Charles, who was helping Peter Corrigan run against Dennis Kucinich. And I thought to myself, now that's someone I want to meet. Hopefully he'll be here a little bit later tonight. And that's the kind of campaign. It's uphill, obviously. An incumbent fellow who's been around forever and with the name ID that Dennis has. But Mr. Corrigan is doing something that's very, very important and which you can help him with. And you can help Kasich. You can help Portman. You can help anyone you want. You can help a pro-life Democrat. I mean, if Tim Ryan, any of you from Warren, Youngstown? Tim Ryan's your congressman? Tim's a wonderful guy. He went to John F. Kennedy High School, as did I. And I see him every couple of years, and I look at him askance and say, what happened to you? What class did you miss? Because he's so liberal on so many things. But if you call up Tim Ryan and you say, look, you're a Catholic. What are you thinking? You can't support this bill. That is so profoundly powerful, especially coming from a fellow Northeastern Ohioan who knows something about the argument, something about the debate. Not to be angry, but to be salt and say, I'm going to have to work against your opponent. I don't know who it is. I don't know who he or she is. I'm going to have to give him 10 bucks or 25 bucks. Let them know today, because the next 3 weeks decide this. It's really remarkable that this conference is unfolding at this moment. And it's providential, as I said, because the next 3 weeks decide it. Every leader has done their job. The bishops have been magnificent. They have come forward and they have said what they needed to say. They have said, we will not change our mind. We will not move. So join them in that effort. And please also, one last thing, it's not in my notes this morning, call these talk shows and urge people to do this yourself. I can say it 25 times, and I do a day. And it has some power, but the power of it diminishes every time I repeat myself. Every time a caller calls up and says, I took time from my job today. I was driving home. I put the kids into timeout and told them, don't bother me for the next 10 minutes. And I called my congressman, and they didn't talk to me, and they hung up on me, and they wouldn't let me through, but I'm going to send them an email afterwards, and I encourage everyone else. That is so powerful. It's a force multiplier, as they say in the military. And I'm looking around at a bunch of force multipliers. You're the first wave. You hit the beach early this morning. Thank you for doing that. And thank you for being here at this conference. Molly, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this Bringing America Back to Life symposium presentation brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life. Please encourage others to listen to this and the other 11 presentations. We hope you will join us next year in our nationwide effort to bring America back to life. For information about our symposium or for more information about our full set of audio and video products, call 216-661-3000 or visit our website at clevelandrighttolife.org.